Saturday day in Salem. This is June 16th. This is the Joint Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on General Government. We were scheduled to have work session on 25:30, and we are going to hold that over. And we were also scheduled to have a work session on House Bill 3099, and we're going to hold that over. And with those two items put on the back burner, then we will open our public hearing on House Bill 3242. Ms. Matt, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you.
You got away from us.
Yeah, I dropped something.
Well.
All right.
I hope it wasn't what you wanted to talk about.
Are you ready?
I am ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee.
Thank you.
House Bill 3242 comes to you from the House Committee on Consumer Protection. What Sue's passing out is some brief overview information that I prepared for you, the staff measure summary, the fiscal impact, and the bill. Basically, and I won't do this justice, and I know there's a bunch of people out in the audience who are going to do a much better job of just describing to you what the bill does, but it establishes endorsements for contractors, and primarily it's aimed, I understand, at commercial contractors, but it would also change how CCB would do all their licensing with respect to even residential. They would have endorsements as well. The specific endorsements are intended to recognize the different insurance, bonding, education, and experience requirements, and primarily in recognition of the different risks and dispute resolution needs of commercial and residential construction industries. What I attempted to do on the back page of the overview memo is build a grid or a matrix that shows you the endorsements, and then across the top the different requirements of surety, bond, liability, insurance, training, and you can read those there. And I tried to lay in the operational dates, and in talking with Mr. Smith this morning, there seems to be some complexity around the operational dates between the endorsements and the bonding requirements. And I also wanted to point out, as I note in the overview memo, that there may be some conflicts between this bill and House Bill 2654 regarding the surety bond requirements. So as this moves forward, we have to be aware of that. And I just wanted to call out that the magnitude of change facing CCB between this bill and 2656 is going to be really large. And so I just want to keep that in front of people as this moves forward. And, Mr. Chair, you've got a lot of people signed up for public testimony, so I'm going to stop talking now.
Do I have a sheet?
I'll get it for you.
Thank you.
Well, it doesn't look like Craig signed up to testify, but if you'd like to have him come up, you certainly could.
We'll wait then. I think we'll start out then with Jessica and Andrew. Is it Fire from Walsh Construction?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Richard, those are not, we don't have copies for everyone, thankfully, of all of that material.
Jessica?
Yes.
If we intend on a Saturday morning to present the entirety of all those materials, that we have put on the table there I should advise you that your time is going to expire before you get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate that. I believe these are more visual aids, Mr. Chair, than we won't be going through these.
Okay.
House Bill 3242 is a bill that represents a tremendous amount of work on the part of the Associated General Contractors to, at its core, improve the industry, the commercial sector of the industry, and bring us to where we believe we ought to be in terms of licensure in the state of Oregon. I have with me today Mr. Andrew Beyer, Mr. Larry Sitz, Mr. Jeremy Vermilia, and Mr. Steve Mullaney, all of whom spend their lives working in the commercial construction industry, to talk more about this bill, why we're doing what we're doing and what it does and why it's important. But let me start by saying at the core of this is about change for the commercial construction industry. And while the bill does change how CCB licenses contractors and moves from a license system to a license with several endorsements, it doesn't change the requirements for residential contractors. Indeed, all of those requirements stay the same. It changes the scheme, but it doesn't change their requirements or their process in any way. It remains the same. We've presented you with two pieces of testimony. The first is piece of paper looks like this. It briefly outlines the bill and then talks on the second page about the differences between residential, small commercial, and large commercial construction and the impact those have. Mr. Vermilia will talk more about why that's significant. Additionally, there's a letter from Mr. Walt Gamble, who is a contractor with Osmond Evans Constructors, also a member of the CCB and an AGC member, strongly urging your adoption of this bill. Wanted to highlight that letter for you. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn this over to Mr. Beyer and my other colleagues.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the rest of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning. I'm not a seasoned testifier, so I will apologize in advance for any protocol errors I may make in presenting the materials that I have before me. I'm the president and general manager of Walsh Construction Oregon, which is a homegrown general contractor. Our corporate headquarters are in Portland, Oregon, on Southwest First Avenue. I live in Portland, in Southwest Portland. We've been in business since 1961. We build all kinds of different projects. Most of it is multi-unit housing of all different types, college housing, affordable housing, educational housing, resort housing, in a range of value from $100,000 to $100 million. We put into place about 10,000 housing units over the course of our operation, and support this bill strongly because we believe that the industry needs to get better. And so we're here asking you to help us get better as an industry, to help us better define the differences between residential and commercial construction, to put in place educational requirements for those that aspire to be commercial contractors, and also to set higher bonding and insurance requirements for those that are operating at a level that requires the type of documentation that you see before you. I am concerned that the industry has requirements right now as set by the CCB that don't recognize the level of sophistication that's required to build the type of buildings that are being put in Oregon. I'm concerned on the residential side that the quality hasn't been what it should be, and we are here again asking you to help us both clarify the expectation and also set the bar higher with regard to quality. The reason that I brought these notebooks is to show you, we can talk about the difference between residential construction and commercial construction until we're blue in the face, But this, these two documents are from a house project that I embarked upon, and this is the sum documentation for doing about a 2,000 square foot remodel. So these are the permit documents. What you see before you are three notebooks and a set of plans that were required just at the front end of the project to document the work that was going to be done on about a $3 million 60-unit residential project that would be typical of what Walsh Construction does. It's a business-to-business relationship. We spend quite a lot of time negotiating with the clients on the prime contract. Two of these notebooks are the subcontract documentation. One of these notebooks is just about general requirements on the project. And the reason that I'm showing them to you is that when it comes to construction, the level of expectation and the requirement to document and to very carefully plan out projects is significantly different for commercial than it is for residential. The second part of this is to talk about wanting to recognize the Construction Claims Task Force work. As you are well aware, a team of people from various parts of the industry came together to make some recommendations about improving construction methods and educational requirements. We don't believe that their recommendations are at all in conflict with this particular bill. We believe, in fact, that the two should go forward, and the intent of both, again, is to improve quality in the construction industry. And we believe that the commercial industry needs to set the standard for the industry, and that the expectation that we have of ourselves should improve. So, therefore, we came forward with this, setting the bar higher with regards to bonding and insurance, to set the bar higher with regard to educational expectations, and to set the bar higher with regards to the way that the CCB tracks that information. So, that's really the sum of my testimony. You're more than welcome to read through the notebooks if you'd like, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to pass them around. I'm guessing you may have other things you'd prefer to do on this Saturday morning.
Actually, Mr. Beyer, they're just looking at them, they strike me as material that I might like to read at night when I'm having insomnia.
Exactly.
Might be guaranteed cure to insomnia. So
it has worked for me on many occasions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, were there any questions for Mr. Beyer other than my foolish comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. And if this question has already been asked, you can tell me to go away and I'll find out later.
Okay.
Or you can just tell me to quit and I'll go away later. I mean, anyway. Is this going to have an effect on small contractors who generally do residential but occasionally do commercial work?
Well, the definitions are, I think, clear. The decisions that the contractors need to make about whether or not they want to work both in commercial is going to be a business decision they're going to have to make that they do not currently have to make. We believe that the requirements both for bonding and insurance are reasonable for entry into it. In fact, we spent a fair amount of time trying to understand whether this would be a barrier to entry, and we don't believe it's a substantial barrier to entry, but an appropriate level of expectation. So I don't think it will be that way. That's my opinion.
So if I may follow up, Mr. Chair. So in a product application that the skill set is the same, whether you're doing it on a residential situation or you're doing it in a commercial situation, the only thing that might be different is square footage or square inchage. But to do the commercial application, a person would have to have a commercial contractor's license as opposed to a residential contractor's license.
That's correct. Correct. Two different endorsements.
Okay. And if I may, Madam Chair, and the reason for that, the difference being, I'm just trying to ascertain what the when you have a product application, whether it's commercial or residential, the skill set is the same. Why the difference in the endorsement?
Well, actually, the level of the extent to which we design the details on commercial projects is quite a bit beyond what is required on residential projects. So, for example, when we build a 22-story concrete tower, the waterproofing membrane may be exactly the same as what would be applied to a house. However, you're applying it 21 stories up in the air. Or, for example, when we're working on foundations or we're doing flashings around penetrations, if you're up above four stories, the water pressure and the wind pressure that the building itself experiences is dramatically higher the higher up you go. So the notion of the four-story limitation is to acknowledge the reality that the skill set that's required is actually different, and the level of attention to detail and the level of attention to flashing that goes into the larger scale buildings and larger scale projects is actually different than what you would do on a residential structure. Certainly from a home building perspective, there's a very big difference in terms of the level of risk on the exterior, what we call the exterior skin of the building, which is intended to keep the water out. So we've gone to the standard that will always be a redundant system, so there's in fact two layers of protection between the interior space and the exterior space, and very carefully plan out exactly where we think the water is going to travel when it hits the structure. And that's, again, a level beyond what most residential contractors would go to.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting that wouldn't be a good thing that they did. We are simply stepping up and saying, in our segment of the industry, which is a different segment of the industry, it's our belief, that we should set the expectation higher for what we do. And, in fact, the technical requirements for what we do are substantially higher than what you have to do when you build a two- or three-story home.
Okay. And what I think is the last follow-up, Mr. Chair?
I'm sure it is.
I get the hint. What about interior work such as carpets, tiles, cabinets, painting, those sorts of things.
Right. In terms of the differentiation between residential and commercial?
Yes.
Again, the business-to-business relationships that develop in a commercial project are different than the relationship between the installer of carpet in a home. That's a consumer issue in terms of quality and how it gets applied. There are expectations when it comes to the commercial side. For example, when carpet is applied directly to concrete, it's very important that the concrete is tested for moisture content, for example, so that the glue will perform appropriately and the carpet will stay down. Again, the level of expertise and expectation is somewhat different in the commercial side than it is in the residential side. And so is it appropriate for people to have both a residential license and a commercial license if they want to operate in both of those environments? My belief is, yes, it is. And that when we hire lots of small subcontractors, lots of minority women and emerging small business subcontractors, And part of that process is to help them understand the difference of operating in what might have been a smaller market or home building market as compared to the bid process and the documentation process, the insurance requirements, and the just even how you get paid is different in the commercial world than it is in the residential world. And those that we've tried to set the bar in a way that encourages people to start their own business and get involved, to spend time, if you look at the educational requirements and the expectations of experience, that we believe that people learn how to be contractors, that learn how to be builders by building. So when you look at the years of experience that's being expected in this bill, what we believe is that people learn how to do this by doing it, and that in order for them to step up into the commercial realm, which people do all the time, they should have the experience of knowing how to be a craftsman at their trade, whatever that trade is. And so that seems a reasonable expectation. And what we don't want is people trying to come into this portion of the business without the type of experience that will help them be successful and deliver quality products, quality buildings that will last a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any more? No, I'm done for now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Sir, what effect would this have on the cost of minimum liability insurance?
Well, I'm not an insurance broker, but I can tell you that the number of claims that the insurance companies are experiencing are dominated by claims in the residential market. And as
that's really not what I was getting at. What I was getting at is you've increased, as I read the bill, you've increased the liability limit, and that's obviously a. I'm told from a lot of contractors that that is really the limiting thing from allowing them to get into if they can't put up the money for the liability insurance bond or liability insurance in the bond. So what I'm asking you, by for increasing the liability insurance to that to the extent that this bill does, what effect will that have on the premium?
Oh, well, I can't really answer that specifically because the insurance analysis that a broker does as to what they think the risk is of any given contractor is very different. My view is that over time that it will actually improve the cost of liability insurance because of the reduction in the amount of claims. That's my personal view. We have experienced a dramatic increase from about 0.5% of cost per project to over 1.5% of cost per project just for liability insurance. And in condominium projects, for example, if the cost can go upwards of 5 to 8% because the claims have been so extensive because there have been lots of problems on residential projects that the Construction Claims Task Force has looked at. It's our belief that and our goal is to improve quality in order to reduce claims, and that the long-term effect that that will have, it will be to actually reduce the cost of insurance and improve the availability. There was a time 3 years ago where we were concerned, Walsh Construction, we've had one claim that's gone to litigation in our 40 years, and we paid out $50,000 on that claim. And 3 years ago, we were concerned as to whether or not we were actually even going to be able to get insurance with what I would have to call a stellar record of quality and a great reputation for both providing that quality and standing behind it. And that's one of the reasons why we are here working on this bill and have been working on it for the last 2 years, because I truly believe that the industry needs to improve the quality that we provide to the people of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. And then we have Mr. Sitz and
good morning.
Barry doesn't need my plan, so I'll get him out of the way now.
I'm Larry Sitz. I'm the president of Emmerich Construction Company, based in Portland, Oregon. been an Oregon contractor since 1942. I've worked there since 1975. We do about $60 million a year in commercial construction, mostly in Oregon, some in southwest Washington, some in eastern Washington. Lots of schools. And a fair amount of stuff around the mall. It renovated the Oregon State Library and the Public Service Building. We built the State Archives Building. If anybody remembers the controversy related to that particular building at the time, we were the contractor. We didn't design it. We just put in what they put on the drawings, those same drawings that Andrew spoke of.
I hope they were different than these, Larry. And,
so, in response to part of your question related to the expense of liability insurance and how much it would change with the introduction of this language, I don't think a lot, because nearly all commercial projects in the specifications, which is one of those books, the requirements of the project are greater than $2 million generally in the Oregon marketplace right now. So this essentially is just catching up to what is actually happening in the Oregon marketplace in commercial construction in this kind of business-to-business relationship where it's defined by the specifications, not by state law, what the insurance requirements are. Does that make sense?
Sure. Question.
What I was looking at, I understand that, that in the larger construction companies, you're responding to that. I was thinking more of the minimum insurance requirements for a remodeler or someone of that nature, if that would, if this bill would increase the premiums of the liability because if you increase the exposure of the insurance company, if you would be increasing that that premium to the point as it would be a detriment to the entry level individual.
And our point is that in that condition, that project has a book that looks like this that starts the job, and that remodeler would not be allowed to bid that project if they don't present $2 million worth of insurance, because that's what the owner demands. It's not the state law. It's because the specification requires it. And that's typically what's going on in commercial construction in Oregon right now.
Could you put a dollar figure on that? I've asked three times now. Could you put a dollar figure on that?
I'm guessing it's going to be 10-15% premium over the $1 million, but I don't know.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay.
But we can get the answer. And you wish that we do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks.
My role here this morning is to give you a brief summary of the bill, and I'm going to try to do it fairly brief because you have it in your text. It's been talked about. You've had it summarized already by your own staff. First point, we're kind of broken into two parts. We have general contractors and subcontractors. And so in that language says general contractor, but it says specialty contractor, but that means subcontractor. It's the people that work for the general contractor. Okay. Then we have two levels. And the reason for the two levels is level one is where we hope everybody ends up someday, and that's the people that have grown up. Level two is the entry levels, and it's designed specifically so the requirements are less than level one. But they're also designed to try to not limit entry into commercial construction industry in Oregon. And in general, they're fairly close to the current requirements that CCB has for contractors. And so the concept being, if you could have qualified or you were qualified before, you still are, hopefully everybody who enters the industry through a level two door aspires to reach level one by their own choice. There actually isn't a demand. They are not forced to have to take that step. but we think they will choose to do that because they can use it in their own marketing efforts. They can say, I'm a level one general contractor in the state of Oregon. And to that extent, there really is no, we are not proposing the state is allowed to say only level one general contractors are allowed to bid on this work. It has to be open to all commercial general contractors in Oregon. Bonding. So typically the requirements for level two entry and for specialty contractor, the subcontractors, are less than level one. And I will talk about the level one, and you can read on the paper what how much less the other steps are below that. In bonding, we're proposing a $75,000 bonding level. With the current law revisions, current requirement is $20,000, and there was just a change recently. Liability insurance, the general commercial level one contractor, $2 million. The current requirement is $500,000. Experience for level one contractors, 8 years of experience in the group of people that are your key employees in the organization, and that experience can be schooling in the workplace, but it is related to the industry somehow. And it's not just one person. It can be combined resources of people within the organization. There are currently no educational requirements for contracting in Oregon. Continuing education, level one contractor, 40 hours per company per year, and that's a cumulative 40 across your whole personnel set. And then the new construction building envelope warranty. This would be typically, this specification is going to say that as part of the contract requirement, there's a one-year warranty on the building. We're saying because in particular of the problems for envelopes in Oregon, in Western Oregon, and water intrusion, that we think we should be putting a two-year warranty on our work. And for lots of reasons. But we want to make sure we quit building buildings in Oregon that are leaking. That's part of the press that we're trying to do. And finally, the independent contractors workers' compensation requirements. This piece is designed to make sure that everybody that works on a construction site in trades, swings a hammer, uses a saw, solders a pipe, is covered by workers' compensation while they're working on the project. And those are the requirements of the proposal. So I'm open for questions.
Questions for Mr. Sitch?
Mr. Chair, just one clarification.
Clarification.
I may not have heard you correctly. Thank you. I may not have heard you correctly, but did you say that the CE requirements were 40 hours for the entire operation? Or
yes.
So if you had 400 employees, you would have 40 hours of CE. If you had two employees, you would be required 40 hours of CE.
Correct.
Thank you.
No. Key employees, but it's not 40 per employee. It's 40 across the organization.
One point of clarification, Senator. What's it, Mr. Chairman? My name is Jeremy Vermilia, and that is for companies less than five key employees, then the number of hours is actually prorated. So, for example, if you had two key employees, you would only have to have the equivalent of 8 hours of continuing education per key employee, and then once you get over five employees, then it's 40 across the company. So we tried to make it so with the recognition that obviously a smaller company is going to have a greater burden with respect to that continuing education requirement. So as you get smaller, below that five key employee level, then it's broken down on a kind of an employee by employee basis. Now one person could do 16 hours all by themselves, or 10 and six, or however you want to break it down. As long as there's the equivalent of 8 hours per key employee for a company that's less than 5 employees. Does that help to answer your question?
Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions? Did you have some additional comments?
I did, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right.
Proceed.
I think I'm next on the list. My name is Jeremy Vermilia. I'm a construction attorney here in Oregon. I live in Tigard. I have spent a lot of time working on this bill within assisting the AGC in crafting the language and also working with other organizations to try to achieve some compromise. I want to commend the Consumer Protection Committee for the work that they did on this bill and the time that they spent on this bill. There were a number of differences of opinion at the beginning of this process, and with the help of that committee, I think we achieved a great deal in terms of meeting the concerns of various folks that had either disagreements or had concerns about the potential impacts, particularly on smaller contractors, and the committee was very sensitive to those concerns, and I think the product that came out of that committee was a good product. I want to talk a little bit about kind of how we got to where we are, and I'm going to try to address a little bit the questions that were raised by Representative Crummell and Senator Whitsitt as well. First of all, what we have is a bill that reflects several amendments that were made in response to concerns that were raised by the Remodelers Organization, the Building Owners and Managers Association, we made a number of changes in response to those. We also worked quite extensively with the staff over at CCB, and I want to commend them as well for putting the time to work with us to try to get a better bill, one that addressed their concerns and their needs in terms of the implementation of this as it goes forward. They were instrumental in getting the bill that we have here before you today. What we've tried to accomplish here is to draw a distinction in law that exists in the marketplace between commercial and residential construction. Mr. Byers' example of the difference in the drawings and between the two types of projects, the difference in the specifications between the two types of projects is an apt one. I spent a lot of time in my practice working both for small residential contractors, for remodeling contractors, but also for large commercial contractors. So I know how the process works on both sides of this issue, and I'm sensitive to the needs of both types of contractors. What we tried to accomplish is to draw a line between the two sides of the industry that made the most sense and was the most sensitive to the need to try to raise the standard of quality on the commercial side and also to be sensitive to the concerns of the smaller contractors and the concerns from the consumer protection side as well. The way I view this is, and Mr. Byers kind of touched on this issue, when it comes to the regulation of residential contractors and the residential commercial or the residential construction side of the industry, you're really looking at it as a consumer protection issue. Most buyers on the residential side or on the remodeling side of the industry are single purchaser or one-time purchasers or once-in-a-great-while purchasers. In other words, you buy a home once every few years or once every 10 years or longer. On the commercial side, you're generally speaking, particularly when you're talking about large commercial structures, you're talking about institutional buyers, you're talking about sophisticated buyers, and you're talking about business-to-business contractual relationships. And what we tried to do was to recognize, on the one hand, the need to protect the public and the need to protect consumers and providing the Contractors Board in particular with the tools to allow them to regulate appropriately on the residential side where necessary. At the same time, leaving the freedom and the flexibility for businesses to engage in commercial contracts free somewhat from the impositions that may be necessary on the residential side that may not be necessary on the commercial side because you have sophisticated businesses and you have more equal bargaining power
and people who engage in construction of projects on a more regular basis, so they are much more able in terms of negotiation to understand the ins and outs of the contracts, the ins and outs of the construction documents, the ins and outs of the documents, and the risks that are associated with those things. Whereas on the residential side, obviously, you have a bargaining power disparity and an understanding disparity between a homeowner and a residential contractor. So with that in mind, we undertook to try to create this division. And what we've ended up with is we will not change, for example, your license number if you're a contractor. Contractors will retain the same license numbers that they had. There's a single license, and this is a fairly technical and esoteric issue, but there is one license. There are endorsements that are attached to that license depending on the type of work that you do. We changed, there has always been kind of an overlap between commercial and residential construction, and that overlap exists in the arena of small commercial structures. We've expanded that overlap so that the size of the small commercial structures is somewhat larger. And the reason that we did that was in response to concerns that were raised particularly by the Remodelers Association with respect to work that they perform on, for example, apartment buildings, apartments to condo conversions, and things of that nature. In the old law, or in current law, a residential structure is defined as one that is either a single-family home or up to a four-unit, for example, a fourplex, smaller than four stories, and that's wood frame. It excludes things like hotels, motels, larger apartment complexes, etc. A small commercial project is defined as anything that is from ground to ceiling 20 feet, that is less than 4,000 square feet in size. Those two definitions were changed. Residential construction now includes any residential structure that is four stories or less in size, that is a wood frame project that does not contain a commercial component to it. So, for example, mixed use condos would be considered to be commercial, but an apartment complex would not be considered to be commercial. And so that expands significantly the size of residential work and eliminates the need to be a dual endorsee for doing that kinds of projects. Similarly, the size of a small commercial structure was changed from 4,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet. So you're talking about anything from a small 7-Eleven, a gas station, a small office building that has a footprint of 10,000 square feet or less. And then finally, and that was in response to a number of concerns both by remodelers and by home builders who, for example, home builders were concerned that they did not want to have to, in a subdivision project that has, for example, a clubhouse in it, they didn't want to have to go out and hire a separate contractor to come in and build the clubhouse when they were building a large subdivision for which they only had to be licensed as a residential contractor, but then have to go out and find a commercial contractor just to do this one small component of that project. This amendment, expanding this to 10,000 feet, addresses that issue and also addresses the concerns that we heard from some of the remodelers about, you know, the size of those remodel projects. Similarly, the 12,000, we've increased the size that you can do residential, or excuse me, a remodel project and have it still be considered small commercial. And the reason for this is, for example, if you have a tenant in, let's say, the Washington Square Mall, with a 3,000 or 4,000 square foot tenant improvement, when one tenant leaves and another one comes in, and you need to redo that space, in the current law, you define the space based on the footprint of the entire building, not based on the size of the tenant improvement. And so that work would always be considered large commercial.
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm just trying to understand this, and this is. I thought this was a very simple bill when I first was exposed to it, and I'm discovering that's not the case. Let's assume this scenario. I own a 100,000 square foot warehouse, and it has a suite of offices in it, and I want to have the offices spruced up. I've just had a home built, and I love the contractor who did the work, and I want him to come in and spruce up the offices in my great big warehouse. what kind of license, or is under this bill would that now be prohibited?
So long as the tenant improvements are less than 12,000 square feet in size, that contractor does not need to have a commercial endorsement. They can do that work with a residential endorsement.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So even though the suite of offices is embedded in my 100,000 square foot warehouse, as long as the office space itself is not greater than 12,000 square feet, my favorite home builder can come in and do it.
That's correct, Senator. Yes.
Thank you.
And the reason that we took this approach is you're trying to create as much flexibility for the smaller builders and the smaller remodelers as possible. So we expanded the size of the available work for them to do without having to go through the process of obtaining that second endorsement.
Let me just follow up. If my office suite is 15,000 square feet, then there would have to be a secondary endorsement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, if you have a single contract that governs the entire remodel of that work, that is correct if it's 15,000 square feet. If, for example, however, you have, say, five offices within that 15,000 square feet, so 3,000 feet per office suite, and you let them as separate contracts, say they're staggered in time, or for whatever reason you don't do them all at the same time and you need to have different contracts govern that work, then each of those are addressed or governed by that individual contract, and that individual contract would not be subject to having to have a second endorsement.
One last follow-up. Doesn't that kind of analysis of how I would break up my project lead to gaming the system?
Potentially, but I think there's always the potential for gaming the system, no matter what kind of licensing scenarios you set up. I think, though, you have to allow. I mean, there has to be a line drawn somewhere, and I think to the extent that the gaming goes on and is discovered, obviously that's why we have the CCB there to address those kinds of issues. To the extent that the needs of the owner dictate staggering the project, letting it separately, et cetera, there are legitimate business reasons why you would need to do that. So I think those kinds of scenarios have to be addressed on an individual case-by-case basis.
One last follow-up, and I just want to put Mr. Smith on notice that when he gets his turn at bat, I am very interested in knowing whether or not CCB has the horsepower to, in terms of literal people power, to be out doing adequate enforcement either on this bill or on the other one, 2656. It seems to me that CCB's plate is awfully full right now, and I just want Mr. Smith to know that I'm going to ask him about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, if I may, my experience in handling contractor claims is that these issues come to the CCB when somebody ends up with a problem. If the relationship doesn't work and a claim is brought to the CCB, then they would obviously deal with it at that point. Again, no system where you try to draw a line, where you try to create classifications, is going to be perfect. There's always going to be gray. I think that this bill has done it. Made great strides in trying to find the line that is the most accommodating of the people who are the most concerned about its impact. The fiscal impact on the individual contractors, even if they do end up having to get dual endorsements, is relatively small. I believe Representative Crummell asked the question earlier about what is the impact if you are somebody who is doing primarily residential work or small commercial work and therefore don't have to have a commercial endorsement, but you get into a project or two a year where you do need to have that second endorsement. And the answer to that is essentially you have to check off a second box on the license application where you indicate that you are going to be performing both residential and commercial work, and you have to obtain two license bonds, one on the residential side and one on the commercial side. The size of those bonds at the level two commercial contractor level is identical. They're both $20,000 bonds. The premium on such a bond is relatively small, a few hundred dollars per year. Generally, those bonds run about 2 to 4% of the total. The premium on the bonds run about 2 to 4% of the total bond amount. So you're talking about just a few hundred dollars per year to obtain that bond. Beyond that...
Mr. Verhey.
Yes.
I have to advise you that you're running out of time.
I'm going to...
There are a number of people here from other areas who are apparently in opposition to this bill, and we want to ensure that they have adequate time to explain their position. We started a little bit late. We'll carry over that much as far as time, but I figure you've got between yourself and Mr. Malney about 7 or 8 minutes.
Fair enough, Mr. Chairman. I'll close at that point.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Steve Mullaney with PNC Construction. I'm president. We're a general contractor in Gresham, Oregon. Our company has been in business for over 45 years, and we currently employ 105 employees. These two gentlemen behind me are fierce competitors of mine, but we've come together because we want to increase the level of quality of the commercial construction industry. We're a proud member of AGC, and additionally, I had the privilege of serving on the Construction Claims Task Force as one of the 9 members, and I bring that perspective, both perspectives, to this, to my testifying today. The House Bill 3242 represents over 2 years of the AGC's work. At the same time, I was working on the CCTF, and I was able to watch both of those efforts grow and transform into their final products. Coming from this unique perspective, I believe and I know that House Bill 3242 can stand on its own merits and is good for the construction industry. At the same time, it complements the work of the task force and the legislation that it was recommended. One of the key findings that we found in the task force and that you have heard repetitively today is there's a huge difference between residential and commercial contractors. Commercial contractors were business to business. Residential is consumer business. I think, Representative Crummell, your question was, is painting a residential and painting a office building the same at the craft level? Yes, it is. But we're businesses dealing with businesses, and that's the big difference there. The painter can paint the wall the same no matter where he's painting it. It's the business-to-business relationship that we are trying to improve and bring the residential contractor up to a higher level into the commercial construction industry. Please be assured that as House Bill 3242 increases the standards of the commercial construction, it also maintains our construction community's commitment to leaving the door open to opportunity. All the AGC firms all started out as emerging businesses, whether it was 47 years ago, like PNC Construction, 47 months ago, like the people that broke off from PNC and started their own business, or 47 weeks ago. We are all constantly reminded that we must keep the door open to emerging small businesses and allowing them to enter the construction market, the construction, commercial construction market. As a commercial contractor in Oregon, I firmly believe that this bill will make the industry stronger. AGC has a core set of principles that we all live by. It's skill, integrity, and responsibility, and I believe that this bill encompasses all these principles and will help the emerging businesses to learn and embrace those core principles. I believe this bill is good for the contractors, good for the owners, and good for Oregon. Please support House Bill 3242, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? You've done very well. You got me made up in a little time for me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I skipped a couple paragraphs because I thought you might enjoy that.
Okay. I have Phil Peach, Greg Olson, and Mary. Is it Mary Mann? But of course, Mr. Kefouri.
Thank you.
you can come on up and pull a chair there over with you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Corey.
Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning. I'm representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. We are opposed to the bill. I'd like to tell you a little brief history. It's kind of an interesting story what happened. During the interim, the Associated General Contractors came to us and said they had a concept, and how did we feel about it? And we took a look at it and said, yeah, here's commercial contractors on one side and here's residential contractors on the other side. As long as it doesn't affect us, we don't see a problem. Then when we saw the bill, actually during the legislature with specific words in it, we became concerned. In the abstract, it makes sense to have one set of laws for commercial contractors, another for residential contractors. But in the real world, there's an overlap. And it's not the clear-cut distinction that it appears on paper. And the more that we spent time with our members discussing where those potential overlaps might be, the more we discover that they exist out there. So the AGC, to its credit, came to us, as Mr. Brumminga said, and we spent a lot of time in good faith trying to work out a compromise in this bill where the contractors who do commercial work would be separate from those who do residential work. We finally ended up with a three-hour session in our, with Mr. Brumminga, who's a member of both organizations, actually, spent kind of mediating, and we looked through every single possible option we could, trying to find it. At the end, we just couldn't do it. This bill then came to the committee, and the committee heard the same testimony that basically you're hearing today. And at the end of that testimony, they voted it out. But, Mr. Chair, they voted it out with a message. Every single member of that committee, and you have some on your committee here, said, this bill is not in final form. It still needs some work. That was a message from everybody who voted the bill out of committee. Now, unfortunately, legislative leadership, in its wisdom, decided rather than sending this to the Senate Substantive Committee and have it go to Ways and Means after that, where it could have had some more work, it sent it to a Ways and Means Subcommittee. Not that your committee isn't a fine committee, but that's not your job, Mr. Chair, to work out the details of substantive issues. And that's the problem with this bill right now. I have some members here from who are actual contractors can tell you about what their specific problems are. I just wanted to outline the general concern. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that there is a $400,000 fiscal impact of this bill, and that money will come out of our fees. And we could think of a lot of better ways to spend that money, Mr. Chair. We have problems of unlicensed contractors out there, and we'd like to give Mr. Smith and his agency more. I know you already have given them more, but we'd like to have them focus their efforts on going after the bad guys rather than trying to find out who's a commercial contractor and who's a residential contractor. If there were some overwhelming public benefit, we could say, all right, we'll take the hit because it's really good for the public. But frankly, Mr. Chair, we don't see that this benefits the public in any way. We think it may benefit large contractors, but we don't think it benefits the general public. So we're opposing the bill.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Peach. I'm CEO of the Oregon Remodelers Association. We represent about 370 remodeling contractors and specialty contractors, subcontractors, and other businesses. To sum it up, we represent the little guys. Two-thirds of our members are five or less employees. Our typical member is the owner and spouse, and it's everything from general contractors to specialty painters, plumbers, people that do just countertops, handymen, carpet layers, etc. All levels clear up to full service residential remodeling companies as well. You've heard that there have been some amendments to the bill since our original hearing on April 6, dealing with the small commercial structures 12,000 square feet or less, and residential is four stories or less. Although I must mention there are a lot of apartment buildings that are well over four stories, especially in the larger metro areas. The fact still remains that this bill, even with amendments, would prohibit remodeling contractors and subcontractors from working in most commercial buildings. And, of course, there are definitions in there as well as to what that includes and, more importantly, what it does not include or specifically excludes without obtaining separate bond for four and five times the amount of their current bond, and much higher liability insurance, and, this is key, workers' comp. currently an independent contractor is exempt from workers' comp, and obviously if they want to do any commercial work whatsoever or set foot on a commercial project, no matter how small the job may be, they would have to have all of that additional coverage. There, the list is endless, and I won't go for too long, but it's clear that this could drive up costs for commercial building owners. The ramifications on rural areas are significant, where you only have so many contractors in the area anyway, and it now limits your choices as to who's available. Throw out some examples, whether it's Pendleton Airport or a hospital in Springfield. Presumably they would have full-time maintenance staff, but if the staff doesn't have specialty in, let's say, plumbing, and they want to replace all the sinks throughout the facility, they would now have to go to a more expensive commercial contractor to do so. Many of aspects of the bill we have been in support of all along. We worked with the Construction Claims Task Force and the CCB and favor things like continuing education, raising the minimum bond, and so on. These were introduced as separate bills. We were frankly a little surprised that they were in this bill. In fact, there's a little of everything in this bill, in addition to licensing and warranties and a significant workers' comp policy, lien law, priority claims language, and so on. And frankly, if this was an initiative petition, it would be thrown out for violating the number of subjects that are in it. If the goal of this bill is to establish a definition of commercial contractors as an elite class of their own, that would be fine, but not at the expense of thousands of small remodelers who depend on the ability to do jobs in a variety of settings. We were asked on April 6 by one representative if there's a turf battle between residential remodelers and commercial contractors. Well, we're not aware of one. In fact, we kind of think the current system has worked quite well and that this is sort of a solution in search of a problem. To sum up, we believe that this bill, frankly, is very anti-small business, which is why we're opposed.
Good morning. My name's Mary Mann. I own Goose Hollow Window Company. This is my 27th year in business. I reside at 5215 Childs Road, Lake Oswego. I'm a member of the Org Remodelers, the Multifamily Housing Association, the Rental Association of Greater Portland, past president of the Independent Contractors of Oregon, and I spent three legislative sessions dealing with independent contractors laws. I'm opposed to this bill. It's very complicated, and I find it like trying to kill a fly with a bat. I find it very interesting to see the gentleman from Walsh Construction show you all the paraphernalia, all the plans, all the details that they have to go to. And if you don't think that every one of these commercial structures requires that already, we all be a fool. I am in the residential market. I could slip over to do these huge apartment complexes and build them, I guess, but that's not what I want to do. I find that these commercial contractors already are competing against themselves. I'm really worried about who are they afraid of. Most of us are never going to get into that arena, and those that do, they already know the players. Some of these teasers, that I call them, these issues with requiring workers' comp on their subcontractors, already anybody who has a commercial contract as a business owner can specify in their contracts exactly what they want their subcontractors to have. If they want them to have workers' comp, they can require it. If you want to have $2 million worth of liability insurance, they can require it. If they want to have a two-year warranty where the contractor comes back in and inspects the project and validates that the work was done correctly, they can require it. Doesn't need state law to come in and do contract changes. This is kind of micromanaging an industry, so I'm very puzzled why these kinds of things are in there, because big boys behind me already know that they have it. They have 30 to 200 page contracts. I refuse to go into those types of contractual obligations. They scare me to death. They do most of the contractors. So who's going to be playing in that arena? The people who can. When it comes to adding additional insurances, I want to share with you what's going on in the insurance industry. And I sat here about 4 years ago and talked with the insurance commissioner when they had a huge, big public hearing. Our insurances are already telling us what we can and cannot do. I don't care what you want to call me. My insurance company tells me if I want to pay more insurance to work on larger structures, they will charge me more insurance. I personally have made a choice. I got the award for doing most multifamily retrofits jobs in the state of Oregon by the Energy Trust of Oregon. As of 2 years ago, I made a choice to take my insurance down so I only work on four stories or taller. That was a decision I made financially, even though I have no claims. I'm at the top of the heap. I made some choices. I don't do siding. Why? Because my insurance says if you want to do siding, we're going to charge you $40,000 a year to do the siding. Now, anybody who wants to enter this commercial arena, in order to enter into the commercial arena, will have to have that kind of liability insurance before they can play the game. Whatever we do here is not going to cause the insurance industry to change the parameters of their risk assessments on us contractors. So if I don't have enough experience and I don't have enough financial wherewithal, and they will check my financial credit and all these kinds of things, or if I do not have enough money to literally pay for the $40,000 to $100,000 to $200,000 a year for my liability insurance, I'm not going to be doing this work anyway. And we don't need bills like this to tell us how to separate out these lines. Unfortunately for all of us, in the cost of doing business in the state of Oregon, the insurance industry is already doing it. Mr. Villemilieu behind us will also tell you that water penetration issues or improving the quality of our work is not going to do any impact to the cost of our insurances. This has to do with marketplace investments outside of what we want to consider the risk that the insurance industries have assumed. I also have no mold or mildew or water penetration insurance. None of these big boys do either, I'm pretty darn sure. The insurance industry has already said, we're going to cover whatever we want to cover you, and you're going to go hang on these envelope issues. That's why we did support having some envelope certification that applied to all contractors in this state, not just whether you're commercial or whether you do residential. We're all kind of fantasizing that this is going to really help our position with the insurance companies. Ultimately, though, we really want to protect businesses and homeowners and improve our skill levels. And there's everybody who's the movers and the shakers are all moving towards that direction. And my personal opinion is about certification. It's something that Craig Smith with CCB probably will tell you, too. Just because you're certified doesn't mean that you're the best person to do the job. I'm an Energy Trust of Oregon ally. I will tell you there's a significant member, none of us, who are all endorsed and we sit on the list, we're at the top of the pie. Every once in a while, more than they care to admit, we fail inspections. And then they have to keep making us do it until we do pass the inspections. We work with building departments. Commercial people work with architects and engineers and specifications, city planners, city codes. They're not just doing this in a big vacuum so that these people from Burnside just one day decide to become commercial contractors. So there's a lot of other issues, and Phil Peach did not bring it up, but one of them is the workers' compensation issue with requiring independent contractors on these jobs, which would apply to small plumbing contractors, painters, who choose to exempt themselves from the workers' comp program. I personally do not carry workers' comp on me. I carry it on my son. My subcontractors carry it on their employees. I carry a disability insurance policy. Why would I want to duplicate it?
Senator Johnson.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I'm this close to the end of the session. I'm trying to get ready for my committee. If I understood the other testimony earlier, I come from a world where endorsements mean levels of expertise, demonstrated ability. You get a basic license, and then you build endorsements on top of it. It sounds to me, if I understood the testimony correctly, that the endorsements that we're talking about in your world are largely financial, their ability to buy a higher level of insurance. Or under this bill, would you have to have demonstrated expertise or just buy a different level of bonding?
Senator Johnson, my understanding is you would have to do both. I mean, one would be that you would have to show more expertise in order to get into it. That's with a level two is 4 years for a key employee or spread out among your key employees, and a level one is 8 years an individual or spread out among your employees. But there's a lot of – that's why it's so complicated, because one doesn't exclude the other. It also raises the question is, if your key employee is sick that day, do you shut – $1 million project down? Do you shut down do you shut down your job because your painter that has all the expertise is sick, but all the other people know how to paint, they can show up to work that day? I mean, there's a lot of complications here. We also have issues with rural areas being part of the independent contractors. I'll tell you, you get really snobby about what the Portland metropolitan area does and how much money is available and size of contracts. You go into the small rural areas like Phil Peach mentioned, you have limited contractors. They're going to take all the jobs they can get. Not only that, you got to get the cooperation of the business owners. I deal with a lot of big financial invested people who really are cutting the pennies. They want to paint that apartment complex. They get competitive bids, or they reuse the same people because they feel very confident. But under this one, you get into two larger structures, they're not going to be able to use those people, or they're going to have to do what you said, game it. Write all these individual contracts just to get the same result, which is to paint their condominium. And these large condominiums are all, they're pretty serious today. They have their, a lot of painters are going to paint condominiums on the whole exterior, which the whole association is, and that would make them commercial contractors, not just painting a unit. So it gets...
Mr. Olson?
Thank you. I appreciate the committee meeting this morning, Saturday. I've been in the residential construction.
Could you turn the mic a little bit? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for that reminding. I've been in the residential construction sector of contracting here for about 30 years.
I need your name for the record, too.
My name is Greg Olson.
Thank you.
And I've been in the residential construction segment for about 30 years, all in the Portland area. My company is, with regards to remodeling sector, recognized on two levels in the national, on the national level, and in two different formats. This bill is multifaceted. Any one of these issues will require substantial conversation. There's many impacts on this. It says that it's going to change the commercial world, or as testimony has been given, not the residential world. However, it does change the environment by which small business can survive. Some areas of the state, the contractors don't have the luxury of making a business decision to say, I'm going to be exclusively residential or exclusively commercial. With that said, I do agree with a number of the testimonies. Our industry does need to get better. We do need higher bonding. The qualities and standards that we work within do need to be raised. I don't know that this bill gets to the heart of those matters. I, too, can demonstrate large quantities of paperwork to show the level of detail that is necessary to go into our projects. Large projects, by nature, are going to have more paperwork, more details drawn. I would expect that, as we would perform a bathroom remodel versus a $1 million project, there's more drawings associated with that. So volumes of books and drawings are just by nature of the size of the project. Speaking about business-to-business relationships, I appreciate that. I don't know that they are any more simple than what we have to deal with homeowners, as we deal with cats and dogs and children's and families and life and death and everything else that goes into our family lives. As we come into people's homes, we have to take all those into consideration. They require a different level of expertise that I'm sure the gentlemen behind me are happy that possibly they don't have to employ within the ranks of their staff. It can be very complicated. I don't see where this bill is answering any of those problems that has come from recommendation of the task force and by testimony given today. I will admit the lion's share of the issues in this state with regards to CCB and what we're faced with will come out of the residential sector. I don't see where this bill takes care of that. I see where this bill sets up an elite group so that they can be separated, so that they aren't going to be involved in such things. I don't see. It changed the nature of the environment by which we're trying to do work in. And I think it impacts small business detrimentally. And I wish and I hope that you'll find it within yourselves to defeat this bill as it is. But I wish and I implore you that we need to stay focused and work on the solutions and the problems that we do have in this state. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. We have two additional folks, I think, and it looks like they're on different sides of the agenda here, but we'll ask them to come up and avoid any confrontations while they're here. Bill Cross and Angie Dyke. Betsy?
I'll wait and hear their testimony.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can promise to avoid confrontation, but I'll do my best. For the record, Angie Dilks here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. Kind of in a unique position. Had this hearing taken place a few months ago, I would have been up with the last panel testifying in opposition to this bill. However, AGC has worked extremely hard with everyone that has sort of a dog in this fight, so to speak, to try to address concerns, to make changes.
Illegal in the state.
Well, you know, I have other hobbies on the side. You know, can be. We're kind of, we're not in Salem. We're, you know, up there. And I have to give Jessica Adamson a great deal of credit for her diligence on this issue. It's not been easy with people like me out there yipping and yapping about all the problems that we have, but we've had all of our concerns addressed, and we now strongly support the bill. I'd like to, I mean, from our perspective, as licensed electrical contractors, we think of ourselves as sort of being up here, and if the rest of the commercial construction world wants to bring themselves up to about here, you know, kind of throw in a little jab there, we think it's great.
Is that
I better be careful. They're right behind me here. But again, I mean, we really applaud their efforts. We think that it's great that other folks in the industry are looking to raise standards. And I won't go into the nuances of the bill. It's, I think, been pretty well articulated here, both sides. But I just wanted to add our support to this and then stop talking to allow you all to continue on with your day.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Whitson.
Just a quick question. Is the craftsmanship that you apply in commercial structures with electricians significantly different or significantly higher level than that which you would in residential structures?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witz, it's our apprenticeship programs, depending on what most of our apprentices can do, end up doing work on both sides. I guess we don't see this as being necessarily a differential from in our industry as far as skill level with these various levels of the contractor's licenses. We see it more as, I mean, as folks have discussed, it's more on the financial and the other experiences. The continuing ed component of this doesn't apply to us because our standards are already pretty high. I don't think I'm answering your question from the look on your face, but I guess I'm not sure what it is you're looking for. I'm sorry.
You answered the question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association, BOMA. I'm pleased to be here, actually, on a Saturday for a hearing in June 16th as opposed to July 16th.
Or August.
Could I ask you just to have patience?
No.
Yeah, we can get to July and
yeah,
August.
Yeah.
BOMA has worked with AGC, and we're very appreciative of their efforts to address a concern that we raised earlier in the process. Our concern related to the impact on tenant improvements. And I think with the new commercial construction, as already indicated, we're talking about fairly sophisticated projects, sophisticated attorneys, complex contracts, and most of the issues have been resolved you know, during the build, between the builders and the commercial building owners. Where our angst comes is what the impact would be on tenant improvements, and not rehabbing buildings or reconstructing, you know, major remodels, but simply the kinds of tenant improvements that go on day to day. And AGC did amend the bill or recommend amendments to the substantive committee, the Consumer Affairs Committee, to increase that exemption from 4,000 to 12,000 square feet. However, the Legislative Committee of BOMA met earlier this week, and they're still concerned about what the implications may be, because a number of tenant improvements, frankly, are larger than 12,000 square feet, and we don't have an answer per se in terms of whether or not the new licensure requirements, you know, what the impact will be, but we are concerned and would like to see more latitude in the contractors that we would be able to use for those kind of tenant improvements.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Cross? Representative Crumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does it have to do with what's going on in the metro area, Mr. Cross, or does it have to do with what goes on in rural Oregon? Because we really do have a major difference. If we're talking about tenant improvements, you know, in John Day versus or Ontario versus tenant improvements in the Portland area. And the reason why I say that is because in the Portland metro area, or Salem or Eugene or Medford, you probably have a larger selection of contractors from which you can make choices of who you want to hire. But if you get out into John Day or Ontario or Newport, you may not have the same kind of selection. I'm just curious if that is driving part of the issues that you're raising.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think it's a – I don't know that there would be a difference in the concern. Many of the commercial building owners that are active in the organization are in the Portland metro area, and that's where they've expressed the concern. And I think it's with regard to who will be – moving, you know, into this licensure process, who will pursue that path, because many of them, or I should say, in some instances, they are using remodelers now who are coming in and doing, you know, moving the partitions, doing the carpeting, the repainting, that type of thing. And so I guess the concern is, frankly, more in the metro. I've heard it expressed more in the metro area. I don't really know what the difference would be out in the more rural areas, though.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, a comment and a question. The comment is that I think this bill is a very well-intended bill in terms of trying to bring the standards in the construction industry up. In our non-here in the building lives, we deal with a lot of constituent issues, and many of them are have to do with contractors, and I would agree with the earlier testimony that a lot of them are residential. But still, I think when you raise the water in the harbor, all the boats float. My question to you is that I understand that there had been agreement on and off, and then suddenly on the eve of the bill being heard, agreement was off. Is there an opportunity for these issues to be worked some more and brought back to the legislature, either in the context of the Construction Claims Task Force or in some other venue? Could you get to a point where there's some resolution here? Because ultimately, I think what we're concerned about is consumers. And I'm very persuaded by the fact that residential is different than commercial for a variety of reasons, but I'm just trying, in your opinion, to see if there's room to keep working at it. And then I have to excuse myself, Mr. Chair. My committee is starting next door.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, first, BOMA does not disagree and, in fact, does support the goals that AGC has outlined in this bill. And they do support professionalizing and enhancing the industry. They themselves also encourage continuing ed and professionalism as well. With regard to trying to address our particular issue. I do believe that there would be an opportunity to further discuss this. We, and I tried to apologize to AGC because of the earlier negotiations and them reviewing what, with a broader group of business owners, what the 12,000 square foot impact would mean, and we would be very willing to sit down and try and come to a fair conclusion.
Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Other? Thank you very much for your time and testimony. And,
thank you.
Sorry we were a little late this morning, but so it goes. With that, we are adjourned.